Talking to Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.
Hi, I'm Adam.
And I'm Sabine.
Welcome to the 9th episode of Robots. This show focuses on autonomous underwater vehicles, or AUVs, and the challenges with making localization for the deep and small. Our first guest, Navinda Kotege, is an expert on providing relative positioning in swarms of AUVs. We then talk to Mark Sherman, who is the sales manager at Teledyne RD Instruments. He'll be giving us a snapshot image of their Doppler velocity log system for underwater navigation.
Finally, to close this episode with an imaginative jump to the future, Christine dives into the first quarter of Jack Graham's science fiction story entitled Selkies. Also, remember to stick with us until the end of the episode to hear who won last episode's uncertain Roomba competition. And now, here's the news with Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. U.S. space agency NASA has decided to send its Mars rover Opportunity on an 11-kilometer, two-year trek to try to reach a huge crater. Opportunity arrived on Mars in January 2004 to conduct a three-month mission. The rover has since proven extremely rugged, far exceeding initial expectations, and still beaming back data more than 4 years after its original mission. Yet even given this fantastic track record, the new assignment will still be extremely tough. On the rock-littered Martian plains, the rover will not be able to cover more than 100 meters per day in summer and will be completely immobilized during the Martian winter because there is not enough sunlight to provide sufficient power for driving. If the rover does manage to complete its two-year journey, it will be treated to a fantastic view over the 22-kilometer Endeavour crater, where it will also be able to analyze a broad range of rocks at the crater's edge. Following the DARPA challenges by the U.S. Department of Defense and the Grand Challenge by the U.K.'s Ministry of Defense, now Singapore's Defense Science and Technology Agency, DSTA, also held a robot challenge. Robots were required to enter a building, find their way around inside, climb a flight of stairs, travel up an elevator, and touch a few targets. Finally, they had to exit the building, all this without any human intervention and in less than an hour. Six teams competed over prize money of 1 million Singapore dollars or just under 500,000 euros in last weekend's finals. Unfortunately, the great successes in the latest US and UK challenges were not matched. The challenge in Singapore was beset by malfunctioning cameras, broken gears, and total system failures. The performance was so bad that the DSTA decided not to name a winner at all. But, as seen after a similar debacle within the first DARPA challenge, things may look dramatically different for next year. Following in the footsteps of MIT's Open Courseware program and CMU's Open Learning Initiative, Stanford University has launched its new Engineering Everywhere program. The Stanford program offers free online robotics and AI engineering courses. For example, you can take the same three-course introduction to computer science taken by Stanford undergrads by following lectures on YouTube or via iTunes. You can then follow up with courses on Introduction to Robotics, Natural Language Processing, and Machine Learning. For links and more information on Opportunity's Odyssey to Endeavour, Singapore's TechX Challenge, and Stanford's free robotics and AI courses, have a look at our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Navinda Kotege is a research associate at the Australian National University, specializing in localization applied to underwater vehicles. During his visit to Lausanne a few weeks ago, Kotege sat down with Adam to tell him about AUVs and the special challenges that exist when building robots for water. He also describes a new method he devised for localization of AUVs that may help make swarms of AUVs possible. Let's hear what Kotige has to say.
Good afternoon, Navinda Kotige. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on your show.
Can you introduce yourself and your research and what you do?
I just finished my PhD at the Australian National University in Canberra. I did my research at the Research School of Information Sciences and Engineering, and my research was titled Underwater Acoustic Localization in the Context of Autonomous Submersibles. And in that sense, what I did was I used an acoustic technique to figure out where each of the members of a swarm of underwater robots was. And that's basically a one-line description of the research that I did.
So you work mostly right now with AUVs. Can you tell us a little bit about the AUVs you work with?
We are mainly doing our research based on the Serafina class AUVs, and these Serafina class AUVs are quite small autonomous underwater vehicles designed and developed at the Australian National University. These things are about just 50 centimeters in length and about 10 centimeters in diameter, and has 5 thrusters, and they're fully actuated and has 6 degrees of freedom and quite maneuverable in the water. And
what makes them different from other AUVs that are out there?
Well, one thing is definitely the size. They're far smaller than most of the other AUVs which are currently used by the industry and the scientific community. And another interesting aspect for these vehicles are that they're quite maneuverable compared to the traditional torpedo-style vehicle with just one propeller at the back with fins for maneuvering it around, and with this 5 thruster configuration, it's quite maneuverable in comparison to the others.
And why would we want that? Wouldn't 5 motors mean 5 times as much power being used?
Not necessarily, because all the 5 thrusters wouldn't be operational at the same time. But I do agree that it does take more power than a single thruster vehicle, but at the same time, it gives you more maneuverability. If you have different types of sensors on the vehicle, the sensors could be augmented by the maneuverability of the vehicle itself. For example, if you have a linear array of sensors on the vehicle, by rolling the vehicle around, you can get a larger area coverage than with a vehicle that cannot do roll motion. And there are that sort of advantages. And another goal of our project is to have a swarm of small AUVs, and for a swarm to work properly, each of the members needs to have a certain degree of maneuverability. If you imagine a school of fish, how they move around and how they behave as a swarm, you can get an idea about the agility required for the swarm to work.
And why a swarm then? Why not just have one giant AUV or submersible?
That's an interesting question, because we do not claim that a swarm of AUVs would replace a single large AUV as it is used in the scientific community these days. But there are certain things that a single AUV cannot do, which can only be made possible by a swarm, such as taking multiple measurements of, say, temperature in a body of water. If you want to take a temperature profile of a body of water with a single vehicle, you need to take a measurement, move, take another, keep on moving, and by the time that you get to, I don't know, say, the 10th measurement, the measurement in the first instance would have changed already. The temperature would be different. But if you have many sensing nodes, as in a swarm of AUVs, you can spread them out in 3 dimensions in a volume of water and take the measurements at the same time. So that's one advantage, where you can have spread out measurements. And another one would be, if you have sensors mounted on each of the AUVs in a swarm, you would get an array, a sense array, which is reconfigurable and mobile at the same time. Because usually, if you have an array, the geometry of the array is fixed. But if you have your sensor nodes on a mobile platform or multiple mobile vehicles, then it's you automatically get a reconfigurable mobile array. And the third point that I'd like to point out is with an AUV, with a single AUV, you always have the danger of losing the vehicle and using all the mission data along with the vehicle. But if you have a swarm which exchanges the mission data as it goes along, theoretically that would mean even if you lose all your swarm but one, you still recover the mission data. So those are a few of the advantages for a swarm of AUVs as opposed to a single AUV.
So losing the vehicle, this has happened before, hasn't it?
It has on multiple occasions. There was one AUV that was lost under an Antarctic ice shelf because with AUVs, it's very difficult to design emergency stop mode because for land robots, it's easy to just stop, freeze at the same position, switch off all motors. But for an AUV, the obvious answer might be to surface, but if you're under a 200-meter thick ice shelf, that doesn't really work. Mm-hmm. And again, in another instance, one of the Japanese research AUVs called the Kaiko was lost while it was being recovered during a storm where the cable broke and it just sank to the bottom of the sea. So in those sort of situations, it's always painful to use your hardware, but it's also painful if you lose your mission data along with that. But if you have a swarm, especially if you're talking about very small AUVs like the ones that we are working on, these 50-centimeter AUVs, there's always a chance of these being damaged or even eaten by, I don't know, sharks. Mm-hmm. So because these things almost look like little seals and agile like a seal. So we still wouldn't want to lose many of these things, but in theory, we should still recover the mission data even if we lose most of our vehicles.
Yeah, I guess they don't quite taste like a seal either.
They probably would learn eventually that they don't taste like a seal after they bite into a few, I guess. Yeah.
So what are some of the big problems you have when trying to do a swarm underwater?
One of the main problems is the lack of communication modalities. Because on land, we have all flavors of electromagnetic communication and most of them in the gigahertz range. And for positioning, we've almost taken for granted the availability of GPS positioning. But all that is not available underwater because higher frequency electromagnetic waves do not penetrate water for more than a few centimeters. And in order to use electromagnetic waves, you need to go for longer wavelengths. That means slower communication rates. And for positioning, there is no equivalent to a global positioning system that we have on land underwater. So we need to find modalities for localizing or position finding as well as communication links. And that's one of the major challenges for underwater swarms.
So you've managed to actually create a system that can measure the azimuth of another robot and the bearing and the distance. How have you done that, or how good is your system?
Yes, I have managed to implement a system using acoustics, but that's relatively short range, meant for the small-scale AUVs that we are working with. Because usually when you talk about underwater communication or underwater acoustics, people talk about communication links which are several kilometers long, and they usually require very high transmission powers. They use a lot of energy to transmit the acoustic signals, which work quite well if you have the amount of energy on board to transmit at these powers. But with the small AUVs, you do not have that sort of energy on board. So you need to work with very low power, low cost system. And the acoustical system that I used, I developed, uses a maximal length sequence signal, and that's used as the signal, as the source signal for localizing the neighboring vehicles in order to find the position, the range, and the heading angles of each of the vehicles.
Okay, so at which point can we expect to see practical use of such small AUVs? When would we expect to see a swarm of them swimming in the water? Or are we very far away, or is this going to be next year?
Well, we are also hopeful to have it in the water as soon as possible, but unfortunately, in reality, it takes a bit longer. Even though we have developed most of the individual components, such as a communication system, a localization system, and we have designed brushless thrusters and the hull and the main board electronics, each of these systems are currently being tested individually, and most of them work as planned. But it's a matter of putting it all together. It sounds relatively simple, but in reality, it doesn't quite work that way, because most of these things which are supposed to work in synchrony, which are supposed to work together, needs to be tested together. So we are at a stage where we are trying to do testing with each of the modules working together. But to have them in an actual AUV, which is fully functional, that's still a bit far away in the future. But it's, if we keep on working on this, it will be probably a matter of years rather than decades, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the main challenges you have left, other than putting all the pieces together? Do you really have all the pieces, or is there still a few things that are unsolved?
Most of the components are there, but in our research group, we are currently facing a slight budgetary constraint problem where it needs a bit more money to get the things moving. But we are currently in the lookout for an industrial partner who might be able to help us out by helping us to mass produce some of the components, which would reduce the cost. And because in our research group, our main focus is not to build AUVs as such, but to develop the swarming technology that can be utilized for swarming. And we actually would be quite happy if somebody else designs the vehicle for us and gives us a platform where we can plug in our swarming system and enable the swarming behavior.
Thank you very much, Navinda. Thanks for being on our show, and we hope to see some of your AUVs swimming around our oceans sometime soon.
Thank you very much.
To check out what technologies are currently available for the navigation of larger AUVs, we called up Teledyne RD Instruments, which is one of the leaders in making sensors for underwater systems. Mark Sherman will be explaining the technology behind sensor suites such as the Explorer or the Workhorse, with an unhidden interest to scale down to Navinda-sized systems.
Hi Mark, welcome to Robots.
Hi Sabine, glad to be here.
You work at Teledyne RD Instruments, which manufactures acoustic Doppler products for aquatic applications. Can you present yourself and the company you work for?
Sure. My name is Mark Sherman. I'm the sales manager for navigation systems for Teledyne RD Instruments. We are located in San Diego, California. The company was originally founded in 1982 by Fran Rowe and Ken Deans. They basically developed the first acoustic Doppler current profiler, ADCP, and in 2005 we were acquired by Teledyne Technologies, and we operate as a wholly owned subsidiary of Teledyne Technologies.
And what type of sensors do you have at Teledyne which allow an underwater vehicle to know where it is in its environment?
The sensors that we used are based off the ADCP for the navigation group, and it's a four-beam Janus Array convex transducer with 30-degree beam angles.
So maybe you can explain how these Doppler sensors work.
Simply put, a Doppler velocity log is basically an acoustic sensor that provides highly accurate velocity information using the Doppler principle. And simply stated, that is, we send out pings through the water. They either bounce off the seabed bottom or they bounce off of scatter within the water. And as they return to the instrument, we look for the Doppler shift. And by using that information, we give a direct readout in either speed over ground or speed through water.
So if you get the velocity back as an input, how can you actually know where the underwater vehicle is?
Well, we work in conjunction with other type systems, whether it be an inertial navigation system or just a regular magnetic compass where we can do dead reckoning. And what a lot of our customers do is they'll start off and get a GPS fix before they send the AUV, you know, below the surface. And then once we go below the surface, then the Doppler takes over and is giving a velocity measurement, speed over ground, so that they can do dead reckoning.
And on board, what type of vehicles can these systems be used?
We're used on AUVs, which are autonomous underwater vehicles, or UUVs, unmanned underwater vehicles, ROVs, remotely operated vehicles, towed systems, surface ships, unmanned surface vehicles, submarines, and swimmer delivery systems, and diver navigation.
Do you have a typical minimal size of the platform which would be needed to be able to carry these sensors?
Yeah, and in fact, the Explorer, which is our probably newest DVL, is less than 12 centimeters in diameter, the transducer size itself, and it weighs less than 2 kilograms in total system weight.
So do you need any additional material to be able to have lower positioning on your system then?
Not from the DVL standpoint. A lot of our customers do have other type of navigation systems, mostly being in some type of INS, and they're both used in conjunction, mostly fed into a Kalman filter, which basically gives the feedback to their control system or, you know, the recording system of actually where the AUV is located.
What's an INS?
Inertial navigation system. It could be it's basically a device that's a bunch of gyros, and the most recent version are like ring laser gyros.
Recent work by Navinda Kotige looks at how a group of robots can calculate the range and bearing of a 50 centimeter AUV to neighboring AUVs. The AUVs are also capable of complete posture estimation. How would your technology scale down to small AUVs like these, or would they actually work on these AUVs right now?
The best way I could answer that is right now, I mean, we're the transducer size really controls the size of the DVL itself. And the trade-off is as you make that sensor smaller, then you're going to lose range, being able to track bottom or track through water.
Do you see at a Teledyne, like Navinda, an interest in having sensors which are really low power, which have a low update rates, low cost, and low weight?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the Explorer itself, if your audience wants to look at that, was actually designed for smaller AUVs versus the Navigator, which is a much larger Doppler velocity log. And we're looking at even making a smaller footprint for some other systems that we're looking into.
So in Navinda's case, the application was swarming, so you would have many of these AUVs in the water. Do you see a market for having really small AUVs equipped with these small sensors?
Yes, and right now the current market that we're seeing the most interest from is within the what we would call the waterside security or the defense market. For harbor and shallow water security.
Thanks, Mark, for being here with us on Robots.
Thank you.
Over the next four episodes, we'll be running a sci-fi special with our guest Jack Graham, a science fiction writer in Cambridge, Massachusetts. with his accumulated knowledge about robotics and science embedded into his unique stories, he'll be describing his own underwater swarm of Selkies. More of his stories, including ARM and Posthuman Playground, can be read at www.lonesomerobot.com. Christine, the floor is all yours.
Selkies. On a floating islet of iridescent plastic, molded from bikes, coffee lids, disposable razors, and neon-haired trolls, the Selkies lounged, waiting for Mangan, while the solar cells, speckling their torpedo-shaped bodies, drank up the waning sun. Mangan emerged from his boat to stand on the bow, like a general reviewing his troops, then peered horizonward, out across the still, flotsam-dotted waters of the North Pacific Gyre. Kato, the living model for Mangan's first-generation Selkies, flapped across the deck behind him, eager to dive. Kato was a California sea lion. The absurdity of putting a dry suit on Kato each evening before diving was a daily reminder for Mangan of his work's importance. 150 years of toxic DDE and PCBs leaching into the water had left the gyre too toxic for him or Kato to swim unprotected. A version 3.2 Selkie, Skitter, swam to meet them. Kato grunted happily in his bubble helmet. Designing scuba gear for a sea lion was one of Mangan's stranger projects, but the Selkies were his pride. The three series were based on harbor seals. This had complicated the artificial muscles needed for them to haul onto the plastic islands, but had greatly increased their swimming speed. Not put off by the change in anatomy, Kato still enjoyed swimming with them. The remaining Selkies hauled into the water, and human, sea lion, and robots all dove. The heads up on his goggles informed him the Selkies were performing their locomotive diagnostics. In the blue-green depths, shafts of light forming bright areas in the breaks between the plastic trash, the Selkies snaked through the water like crescent moons fallen beneath the sea and grown fins. The curvilinear movements conserved momentum, letting them rotate around their axes of motion while efficiently scanning their surroundings. Like biological seals, they seldom trusted smell. The waters of the gyre were so thick with carcinogens that smell would be useless, so Mangan built creatures of sight and touch. Finished with their diagnostics, the Selkies spread out. Like true seals, they used their vibrissae, sensitive whiskers anchored in haptic sensors, to hunt. Where the hydrodynamic senses of a seal would detect the movements of fish or squid, the Selkies' pattern matching sought the flutter and drift of plastic flotsams, which they devoured. Kato rejoined Mangan as his playmates dove deeper. Mangan chose this area because the seafloor was only 400 meters down. Improving them to work at greater depths was a long-term goal. The Selkies glided slowly along the bottom, using their vibrissae to hunt for more plastic. Kato looked at him and barked. "New function," Mangan said. "They're hunting for the tiny pellets, the nurdles." He looked around at the darkening sea of floating trash. "The Californians call them mermaid's tears." He swam for the surface, Kato and Tao. Below, silvery shapes arched this way and that, silently gathering tears.
Great story. Thanks, Christine. I wonder what's going to happen next. Don't forget to tune in to the next episode for the continuation of Graham's story, Selkies. Before wrapping up the show, it's time to announce the winner of last week's Uncertain Roomba competition. Thanks to everyone that contributed, we had some great discussions on the Roomba's performance on the forum, but unfortunately there can only be one winner. So, the answer to the question, how much colorful dirt can a Roomba pick up in 2.5 minutes, is 38%. Scotty is our winner with the closest guess of 42%. You'll be receiving a copy of Matiusi and Floriano's latest book, Bio-Inspired Artificial Intelligence. A special shout out to HQ, who is thinking of the right answer, but is a little too optimistic of iRobot's finest.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on today's guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Our next show will air in 2 weeks, but in the meantime, stay in touch through our forum for the latest news and hot topics in robotics. Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Sink in to Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.